evening and welcome back to Transatlantic History Ramblings. Oh, Jesus, Lauren, we disappear for a couple weeks in this crowd. They just stop it. Stop. Enough. No more applause. Come on. Stop it.
It was quite a long time.
Yeah, they missed us, I guess, Lauren. But we're back. We took a little unscheduled hiatus, as it were. How you been, Lauren?
Well, I had to have a lumbar puncture, so I am not. I'm better now. So.
Yeah, I couldn't put it all on your shoulders and say it's all Lauren's fault because she got something hard stuck in her bottom.
No, I didn't. I have a condition called idiopathic intracranial hypertension, which means that my body has stopped getting rid of the excess spinal fluid, and it just sits there and chills and causes crazy symptoms like very high blood pressure. Like, I think one day it was like 170 over 140, and I thought, oh, I could have a stroke today.
Yeah, that reminds me of a really bad joke that I'm not going to tell because it's not one of my clean jokes, Lauren, but I'll tell you off the air. But yeah, apparently this condition causes you to do crazy things like do podcasts with obnoxious Americans and get spinal taps. So yeah, it's all your fault.
I was promised memes, Spinal Tap memes, and I didn't get any, so.
Well, I was going to, but I felt bad, because I'm like, we make fun of you a lot on the air, but that's got to suck, and I don't really want to rub it in. Until she's back and feeling better, then I'll make fun of her some more.
It did really suck, to be fair. I don't recommend, because everybody says, how does it cause? I don't recommend, but, I was very lucky. The team, I didn't see any of the equipment for the lumbar puncture because I think I would have screamed if I hadn't seen. But I felt it. The only thing I saw was the ultrasound scanner. So I don't know if the equipment was then brought in after that was brought in, or it was on the one of the bottom trays of the trolley just covered up. I don't know. But they were really good.
I feel the same way when I get a colonoscopy. I don't want to see the equipment.
No, and I was very lucky. I didn't see anything.
I do have a couple messages for you, Lauren.
Okay.
Well, we did get some emails saying, where the hell did you go? Did you get canceled? I don't think we can get canceled.
unless you cancel each other, then yeah, maybe.
It's a free show. We can't really get canceled. No one's paying us. So unless people want to send donations. No, don't send donations. We don't want money. But we did get several emails asking, and then when they, talked about, hope that everything goes okay with getting something hard stuck in your bottom. People love my sense of humor, Lauren.
It wasn't anywhere near my bum. It was, in the lumbar region of the back.
Which is the part of the back right near the bum.
And it was quick. They had to, they do the ultrasound first, and that takes about 10 minutes because they've got to find not just one spot, but a second spot if the first spot doesn't work.
How many spots did it take to get yours?
One.
Ah. So you want the two other messages I have for you?
Yes, please.
Our dear friend and faithful listener, my wonderful friend, the priest from my cigar shop, said... He's so glad you're doing better and they know what's wrong with you. It was the Catholic prayers that did it.
I had a lot of Anglican prayers.
Yeah, but it wasn't until the Catholic prayers kicked in, he says. So.
Well, I don't know. I don't know. Well, I don't know. We're English Catholics. So, I don't know if you can call us Protestants.
The other message I have is from Misha. Misha was back in Buffalo.
Ah, I saw that she's back in New York visiting people.
Yeah, those people were me and my brother and Duff's Wings.
I know. She visited some friends of hers as well, but other than you.
No, she brought them in with her.
Oh, right.
Yeah, she brought them in. Because they all got to experience Duff Wings for the first time. The greatest chicken wings in the universe, Duff's Wings. And we went there and we had a giant Duff's feast with all of us there. It was wonderful. You know, Lauren, I think I'm going to have the owner of Duff's come on as a guest sometime. What do you think?
Could you?
Yeah, absolutely. They love the fact that we talk about him on the show and that you traipse around Wales with a Duff's Wings bag.
I do indeed.
Yeah, but it's been a couple weeks, Lauren, so I know what you've really missed are the jokes. I know. So I have some for you, Lauren.
Okay.
Hey, Lauren.
Yes.
Did you hear about the sound checker who got drunk on duty?
No, I didn't.
He had one too many. Don't you miss the jokes, Lord?
Not really.
Come on, that was cute.
That was cute, yes.
Yeah, well, you know. Did you hear that noise in the background?
No.
Zach, I got one of those clocks. You know those old clocks with the cats that where the eyes and the tail move with the pendulum? You ever see those? They're American kitsch things. I had to put new batteries in it. We were sitting here the other day and the clock had stopped and Sarah looks at it and goes, "What time did when did that happen?" And I said, it looks like 9:37. That's kind of a joke, but it's also true. So you didn't have to laugh at it. Thank you, Lauren.
Do you want to know something fun that happened today? We're having our garage demolished and they were emptying it out of the stuff that's in there. And they found a hibernating hedgehog.
I got a question. Is a garage anything like a garage?
Yes.
Y'all talk funny down there.
We talk funny.
Yeah. Hell yeah. No, seriously, like a hibernating hedgehog, like it was alive?
Yeah. Curled up asleep.
Was it cute?
I didn't see it because I went out to check on it in the hedgehog house and it wasn't there, so it must have woken up and gone out to get something to eat.
Wait a second. A hedgehog house?
Yeah, we have a hedgehog house in our garden.
Are hedgehogs that common there?
Yeah.
Oh, not here. I don't think I've ever seen a hedgehog.
Well, I kind of suspected there was one in the garden because we were having less pests than normal, like slugs and everything. And then all I would see was like the slime and no, and I thought, oh, I wonder if that's because we've got a hedgehog.
How big are hedgehogs?
Like the size of a kitten, a 6-month-year-old kitten.
So they're like a big giant gerbil.
Yeah.
Things like that running around.
There's foxes in my area as well, and bats.
My mother, there's a lot of bats in her building. You know, she calls them the bats.
Yeah.
So, you have a lot of bats there, Lauren. Do you get a lot of guano on your property?
No, we don't get them around our bit, but there's a local Methodist church, and they have two buildings. You've probably heard of it. It's Moriah, where Evan Roberts preached, and he started the revival. So I live quite close to that, and I help out there sometimes as well, and I go to a Bible study there as well. And they have two buildings. They have a schoolroom and a chapel, and the bats have their nursery in the schoolroom and then the roost in the chapel. But they've said that there's been a population decline since a lot of buildings been going on in the area.
So they literally have bats in the belfry.
They don't have a belfry. They just have a roof.
Hmm. Where do the sheep go? Don't tell me you don't have sheep.
Not in the vicinity, not close by me.
Hmm. So, like, hedgehog are common enough that you actually buy a hedgehog house. Now, what is, like, the hedgehog house made out of? Is it, like, the Three Little Pigs house or something?
We need a new one, but it's plastic with wire meshing, and it just looks like a tunnel.
But it's not a house. Does he have a TV?
They're called hedgehog houses, and it's just somewhere safe for the hedgehog to rest overnight or to hibernate in the winter, and you just leave them alone.
You know, it's called a box. You could do that.
Yeah, but this is nicer because the foxes won't, like, tip over the box and eat it. And we have foxes in the area as well.
Why don't you put out a gingerbread house for the... For the hedgehogs. That way they can sleep and eat at the same time.
I don't think gingerbread is good for them.
They'd love it. It would be tasty.
I'm just worried now because even though the garage is empty, I'm worried now it'll go back in there.
Well, if you put another hedgehog house in there, sure. You put a little hedgehog condo, they're all going to move in.
The hedgehog house.
Then there goes the neighborhood.
The hedgehog house isn't in the garage. It's in the garden.
Ah.
But it we had some. I don't know if it got disturbed when we had the storm, because the storm broke the door on the garage. That's part of the reason why we're having it demolished, because it's broken. And it must have gone in there, and it must have seen all this and hidden amongst some of the stuff we had in there.
So, like, it was making its own hedgehog house in the garage.
Yeah.
Well, and that was pretty rude to kick him out then.
Yeah, but we're also demolishing it, so I don't want him to get hurt. I'm just quite glad that nobody stepped on it, because not only would that have hurt the hedgehog, but they'd have had all the spikes in their foot.
So it's like a porcupine.
Hedgehog? The quills aren't as big as a porcupine.
I don't have either where I live. I have rats. It's not like I have rats in my apartment or anything like that, folks. I'm not saying that. But, you know, when they dig up the streets here to repave them, you see rats once in a while. And, you know, we have birds. But that's about it. My brother has fox.
We have owls as well. We have, from the sounds that they make, is tawny owls that we have around here.
Is that the fucker that eats the Tootsie Roll Pop?
I don't know.
No, you have no idea what I'm talking about, do you? But I know there's people out there listening who laughed at that, Lauren, so that makes me happy.
And yes, we have foxes. We have a few cats wandering around, outdoor cats.
I have a few cats wandering around in here.
They like our garden because it's quiet.
Yeah, and they hang out with the hedgehogs. They like get together, have cigars, play poker.
This is the first time we found a hedgehog. So I have seen them in the area, and I have seen them in our garden when we had a cat, because she was quite funny. They would curl up in a ball and she would try and push them.
Push the hedgehogs.
Yeah, she just, and they would roll. They do roll. It's quite funny.
So they get along with the hedgehogs.
What, the cat? I don't know what the cat was trying to do to it. I wouldn't trust her. I mean, she was 24 and still going out and mousing for us.
Yeah, that's pretty badass.
Yeah. And she would announce it when she had a kill as well. That was quite creepy. She was a sassy executioner. I'm worried about that cat.
Sassy executioner.
Yeah, she was. Her name was Sassy.
Oh, well, that's pretty badass then. And she was a hedgehog kicker.
Yeah, I don't know what she's trying to do to the hedgehog, though. So I just picked her up and brought her inside before she did something.
What do you think Cleo would do with the hedgehog?
Try and kill it.
Yeah, she'd beat the shit out of it. Cleo had to go to the doctor the other day.
What did she do?
No, she's got a bad cold.
Oh, cat flu's the worst.
And you know, poor Cleo has those real narrow nasal passages, so her breathing is always loud. And when she gets a cold, she can't breathe at all. It's always through her mouth. And then she coughs and sneezes all the time. And I had to take her to the doctor because I wanted to make sure that it was just a cold, nothing else. So, you know, several hundred dollars later, I get they come back. She's fine. They gave her a shot of antibiotics. And she goes back this week for a follow-up, but she's such a good girl. But she'd still kick the shit out of a hedgehog.
It was quite funny. We had a cat who had cat flu, and he was all right afterwards. But they panic. And the thing with cat flu is that it's not the flu that kills them. It's they go into shock because they can't breathe through their nose. And when cats go into shock, they die.
Which, luckily, Cleo, having had narrow nasal, so that won't happen to her. Luckily, she's a good girl. You know what else I forgot to tell you, Lauren?
What?
Did you see the story about that new airplane, that new passenger airplane they're making?
No.
Yeah. So there's been, you know, a lot of crashes lately and, you know, all these air tragedies. So they're going to make this new plane out of rubber so that if it crashes, it just bounces. Nope, nothing gets hurt. It's going to be made by Boeing, Boeing, Boeing. I don't know if that joke flies. Get it? Flies. In the UK, but Boeing is the company that makes aircraft.
I know.
You still didn't laugh, though, right?
Yeah. That's right.
Pretty nasty, Lauren. Hey, Lauren.
What?
Do you know what the least spoken language in the world is?
I don't know, Brian.
Sign language. Now you wonder why all my girlfriends leave me, don't you?
I just feel sorry for Sarah living with you.
You know, I broke up with some of the girls on my own. I once broke up with a girl because she wouldn't stop counting. I wonder what she's up to. I heard you chuckle at that one, Lauren.
If you say so.
I heard you chuckle, and just for that, I am going to give you the honors of starting our day in history. But before I do that, I want to tell everybody for our interview tonight, there were some technical difficulties. All my fault. My computer kept shit in the bed.
No. The first one was Cleo decided you weren't recording in the right way and turned it off.
That's true. Cleo did turn the recording off the first time. But the other two times, my computer shit the bed. So
Was it twice more?
Yeah, twice more, because I had to put four clips together.
Because I know there was one, and I didn't know what to do, because you suddenly disappeared and the recording stopped. And then I was like, what do I do? So I thought, I'm just going to record. And then, because the guest had a guest of their own coming and wanted to finish in a timely manner, so I was just like, I'm just going to record and then send it to Brian. But then luckily with the program that we use to hold the calls, they get saved to the call, so yeah, they're accessible to everybody. And I quite like that as well, because it means the guests can listen, and if they decide there's something that they're not quite happy with, they can always tell us to leave it out. I like that.
Exactly. Plus, the benefit of this one is there's big sections of the show where you folks aren't going to hear me at all. So
I know. It was like 20 minutes.
I know. I'm sorry. But I just want to give that heads up first. If you hear like weird stops and pauses in between certain lines and sentences, you're not going crazy. It's not defective. The podcast platform you're listening to isn't defective. My computer sucked when we were recording this interview, but we'll get to that in a little bit, Lauren. For now, why don't you clear your throat and give me a good day in history?
Today in history.
Yeah.
Not bad.
Okay. So my day in history is the 5th of March, 1496. Henry VII of England grants John Cabot or Giovanni Cabotto a commission to explore for new lands.
All right. First off, you keep messing with me with these numbered names.
Yeah.
You do that on purpose. You realize that.
Probably.
Yeah, you're just making fun of me. And what year was this?
1496.
Yeah, so they're about 4 years late there, Columbus. Way to go, King. Drop the ball on that one, huh?
Well, the thing is that Henry VII is pretty preoccupied with not getting murderized by pretenders to his throne.
Excuses. I'm just saying, 4 years earlier, Columbus find a giant piece of land. And now Henry's thinking, I'm going to ride those coattails. Sorry, dude. He found the big one. He caught the big fish. What are you going to find? Guam? You know? Not that there's anything wrong with Guam, but it's a little bit smaller. So I'm saying that king sucked.
We've all been regretting Columbus's discovery ever since.
Well, let's face it. First off, Columbus was kind of a dick. He was a pretty bad dude. But the Vikings were here first anyway, so fuck you, Columbus. But your king sucks. Not your new king. I mean, he's okay. I hope his cancer's okay. Thoughts out to you, King. But that King Douchebag the Seventh sucked.
You're just jealous.
I'm not jealous. He was like, ooh, new land discovered. Big, giant continent. Why don't you go find something? Dude, a little late, but that's okay. Is this why people say I'm obnoxious, Lauren?
Probably.
Do you want my day in history?
Yes, please.
My day in history is March 5th, 1750. Is the very first performance in the United States of a Shakespearean play. Huh. Yeah, it was in New York City, and it was Richard III, another fucking name with a number. But I thought that was interesting, that Richard III was the first Shakespearean play ever performed in the United States. I mean, so they claim. I mean, who knows? There could have been some high school theater troupe doing one before then. Who knows?
Probably.
When they weren't busy doing Grease or Carousel, they did Shakespeare in 1750. I had a couple other interesting days in history that I thought were quite fascinating. If you want me to go through them real quick.
Yeah, why not?
Well, it was today in history, March 5th, 1955, that... We've been talking about kings, all right, Lauren? Well, March 5th, 1955, the king, Elvis Presley, made his first ever television appearance on a local TV show in Louisiana called Louisiana Hayride. That was the very first television appearance of the king. Oh. You're not a big Elvis fan, are you?
No, I am. That was interesting.
All right, well... Here's one that's even more interesting. Well, different kind of interesting, but in recent history, I mean, I remember when this happened. But now to look back at it as being part of history, it's really cool. Today in history, March 5th, 1995, the graves of Tsar Nicholas II and his family were discovered in St. Petersburg, Russia.
I remember that.
You remember that? Wasn't that crazy? Yeah, now we live through it, Lauren, and it's now history. You know what else is history? The ramblings of this episode. Because we have got one of our favorite all-time guests coming on, and he is going to, breaking news, being told for the first time anywhere on our show. He's making an announcement to the world, Lauren, via our show. And you know he'll be on every other show after this. He'll be on, like, all the big shows and news channels, because anything having to do with Bram Stoker is world news still.
It is. But
Dacre Stoker is making his announcement to the world for the first time on Transatlantic History Ramblings. How badass is that?
That is quite exciting.
So I'm going to fire up the magic interview box.
It's the magic interview box.
And Lauren, I am going to let you flip the switch. Oh, Lauren, I am so excited for today's show. Do you know why?
Why?
Because one of our best friends and favorite guests in the world is back to give us the big, big, big news, which I think might be being revealed here for the first time. And that makes me happy. But our dear friend, the wonderful author, historian, tour guide, all around great guy, Dacre Stoker, the legend of a legend, is back with us. Dacre, welcome back to the show.
I don't know how to follow that one up. The legend of a legend. You're right, though. I'm Bram Stoker. My great granduncle was a legend. I'm kind of slowly eking towards somewhere below that, but I'm doing my best to, you know, bring to life his legacy and keep it alive. And I thank you too for having me on the show. This will be the first show that I'm actually breaking this news to your audience. You guys obviously know, because I've sent you the sort of the notes, but it really gives me great pleasure to share with you guys that I finally, after 15 years of doing writing and leading tours and giving lectures, that I'm finally, you know, getting my hand at creating a Bram Stoker film documentary. And yes, that is with some friends of mine who I'll get to in a moment, but it doesn't come easy, and it doesn't come without us needing to go onto Indiegogo for a little bit of crowdfunding. And I'll get into that in a few moments. But I think the three of us who have shared number of shows together should really just talk about Bram Stoker and the atmosphere that you guys think a documentary should be filmed in, and how it should be filmed, and imagery, because we've done a lot of the footage is all there. The narration and the script is there. It's the editing that we need the money for, because it's not cheap to get these types of things edited properly. So I'd really love to hear what you guys think about what a Bram Stoker documentary should look like. You guys are two of the most knowledgeable interviewers I've ever worked with, and I say that respectfully, and it would be great
historian and nut.
There we go.
Oh, go, Lauren.
Oh, I was going to say, I think that what would be really nice is that if the narrator had a Dublin accent, as if sort of Bram was telling his own story. I think that would be amazing. And I think somewhere in the afterlife, Bram would get a kick out of that as well.
I will tell you this, parts of this will be in the first person.
That's amazing.
And just because of that feel that you just explained, just so your listeners know, Jason Figgis is a Dubliner. John West, who helped write the script, is from England. He spent time in Yorkshire, one of the places would be where Bram did his research. So both of them come into this with a very sort of natural feel and approach to this story. And they're not trying to make it too glitzy and shiny. They approached me on this and they said, we want it to be, and I love this term because it's guttural, as they say. It's raw. It's Dublin. It is, you know, sort of the life and the world that Bram was brought up in. And so, Lauren, we will work hard to do that. I can't guarantee that people will listen to the Dublin accent and feel that it's Bram Stoker's comeback, but there will definitely be that feel created.
Yeah, I was going to say, it's not a double. Oh, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Sorry. I think that's important because I also think that it should employ some, if possible, it should employ some of the techniques of the theatre as well. And this can be encapsulated if you were to look at like Ealing comedies, for example, Kind Hearts and Coronets, The Importance of Being Earnest, because those actors were stage actors. And what would happen is that they would be on the stage, they would be filming the film during the day, and then in the evening they'd be on the stage. So if you could have some bits set up as if it was theatrical, if the, you know, if there were to be reenactments of some scenes or some parts of Bram's life, then that would be quite interesting, is to set them up in a theatrical way. Or maybe the opening of the documentary could be somebody sitting on a stage in a chair and just sort of setting it up that way. But I think because the theatre was such an intrinsic part of Bram's life, you know, it was, and it was a part of Dracula's story as well. I mean, he did turn it to the stage. He wanted it to be performed on the stage. I think that the theatre and the life of that needs to be remembered as well and memorialized, because that made up so much part of who he was. And I remember when I first started reading about Bram, I was working in a cinema, and one of the things is that he was always there. He always, you know, introduced himself to the theatre goers. He was always visible. And then when I became a manager of the cinema, that was something. If there was a big thing like a theatre production being streamed live, I took that on board, and I always made myself visible, because, you know, people feel special if you've got the manager, you know, taking care of them and everything. And it was just, I was just doing my job, but I always made sure that I was visible, that I was the one that made sure the projector worked properly for that showing, and just, you know, just being there and making people feel special. And that's the whole part of it as well. And I think the intimacy of having it in a theatrical style would make the viewer feel for that moment special, and if in some way Bram is speaking to them directly, because he had a knack of making people feel special. I remember reading that.
You're absolutely right. And let me just if I can fill your listeners in a little bit, Bram getting the break of his life to move from Dublin to London to work for Henry Irving managing the Lyceum Theatre was the opportunity that opened the door up to what was sort of festering in Bram Stoker's life and in his mind at the time, which was the creativity that goes with writing and the sort of the make-believe world of the theater. And he really identified with that in his early years. And I can say that honestly and with my research into his lost journal. So while he was in Dublin, a student at Trinity, he did a couple of years at Trinity, and then he started working at Dublin Castle, which was a very boring job in the Petty Sessions legal department, and he was also taking classes at Trinity. But Trinity was his external life. He was the head of the Philosophical Society, the Historical Society. He debating and drama and athletics to a very high level. But those parts of the day when he was sort of, you know, confined to the castle like Jonathan Harker was, and confined to minutia, worrying about mundane clerkship type things to make sure that people had the right kind of licenses for their dogs or paid the right taxes. This sort of boring stuff is what grounded Bram and slowed down his ascension as a writer and as a theater lover. He became a critic, an unpaid theatrical critic, just to keep his hand in the game while he was being this clerk in the Petty Sessions legal department. And so when he met Irving in Dublin and they hit it off together and spent a night all chatting about the future of the theater, and then within a year, Irving offered Bram the job, and that's when Bram sort of broke away from his his sort of mundane life. He had graduated from Trinity. He got his master's in mathematics. And at the same time, there was another thing brewing. He broke away from his father, who didn't want him to go and do anything associated with the theater, because he warned him with a letter by saying, you know, the theater is not for you. The people are not, you know, they're not good people. And in reality, that was true to a certain extent. There was a lot of theatricals that were not much higher than sort of carny life, and, you know, wasn't a high form of entertainment. But the point was, Bram and Irving hatched plans at the Shelburne Hotel in Dublin to change that. And they went about and did that. And I think it was partly because it was the right thing to do to help Irving in his career and Bram, but also to show his father wrong. So when Bram went off to London, the theater played a huge role in his personal life and his social life. It exposed him to all sorts of people. But Lauren, as you said, it really created the place where Bram could revel in the creatives. And one role in particular that I can tell you right now will be involved in this documentary film. I mean, a lot of things Lauren said we've thought about and we'll edit into. But the role Henry Irving playing Mephistopheles, the devil, in the famous play Faust, that was something Bram was exposed to day in and day out for years. It was the second most popular play that was done at the Lyceum. And if you think about the occult and everything that is pertinent and in the right context, this is what people in London were thinking about when Bram was writing his story and putting on plays at the theater, seance, tarot card readings, mesmerism, all these sort of occultish things. And the devil is what Bram was looking for as his Dracula, the devil incarnate. So the imagery comes from Irving playing Mephistopheles. So I can tell you there will be some representation, Lauren, in the film about that, because it's such an integral part of inspiring Bram to then go off and do his research and finding Vlad the Impaler and all that other good stuff.
Yeah, I was going to say the thing that you have journals is that Stoker had a fascination with spiritualism, theosophy, the occult, that a lot of people read into that and assume he was this Crowleyan-like character, which he wasn't. So I would hope when you represent his interest in the Theosophical Society or the spiritualist movement, you do it as an accurate representation of what his interest was instead of a sensationalistic one, which too many people would go to. You know, don't go for sensationalism, go for realism. Your great-granduncle's story is fascinating enough, and he is fascinating enough to not go out on flights of fancy.
Yeah, I get that. Now, do you remember the Sherlock Holmes films with Robert Downey Jr. and Jude
yes.
Law?
Yes. Yes.
Those, I think, were all about these secret societies and the spiritualism and all this other symbolism and all that stuff. And that worked for that film, right? But that was a film of fiction.
Exactly.
We are doing a documentary, and Brian, I have I share your sentiments, I share your vision, and it also needs, because he's a family member, I don't want him represented as some crackpot who is rushing off to the Hellfire Club to, you know, potentially sacrifice a black cat on Friday the 13th or something that people may think nowadays is what led to the rise in the occult, when in fact people were becoming much more aware of science. They were questioning things, they were questioning religion, they were questioning sort of the stranglehold that formal religion had on both life and death, and sort of what people's thoughts were about what happened after death, as opposed to what was beginning to happen is, what are the spirits really doing? Can we connect with spirits of the dead after their time on life is gone? Very interested people like Mark Twain and Arthur Conan Doyle.
Where Lawrence said, oh, I'm sorry.
There was, you know, high level people that we look at back nowadays and look back at their theories and their ideas and go, my God, they were so ahead of their game, you know, so ahead of their time to think about these things. But it was dangerous back in those days. And that's why these secret societies like Order of the Golden Dawn and Freemasonry did these kind of things in ritualistic ways behind closed doors and secret clubs. And Bram was a Freemason. He was not a member of the Golden Dawn, but he knew enough to dabble in that stuff and to write letters to people and ask them about, you know, what they found. He did a book review on somebody who was talking about Second Sight. So I think we'll do it justice, and I think we need to, Brian, because it is an important part of Bram's persona, and it does come out in the novel. You know, these sort of spirits that are lurking, and what happens when somebody has a nightmare or somebody is doing a trance walk. Those are all part of this thing, and that's what Bram integrates into the story, and I think very well.
No, absolutely.
And I think as well, Dracula himself is an exploration into what happens to a body after you die. I mean, because at the heart of it, you know, Dracula is the undead. And I think that's, and I know it's controversial to like the modern retelling of Dracula by Stephen Moffat and Mark Gatiss. And I do, simply because they captured that spirit. I think having a faithful retelling of Dracula at that point, before the pandemic, would have been lost, especially from those two, because they would have been expecting something a little bit more extra. That's what we got. But I think after the pandemic, we could really use that, because, again, the pandemic brought up questions of what happens after death. And I think that Bram's work has a certain resonance, especially in these times when we are sort of, even 4 years on, we're still trying to make sense about what we went through in 2020. You know, and the, you know, there's still things today that have been impacted or changed because
Lauren said a nice, oh, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off. You froze for a second. I thought you finished. I'm sorry.
Well, that's okay. If I froze, I don't know where I was frozen off.
Just for a second. So just continue on.
And there's things today that the pandemic impacted that we are still reconciling, and things that, you know, we, even in my work now, we come across things that have been, that we're still trying to unpick and unpack after the pandemic is still causing chaos, even nearly half a decade on, you know. So I think that even if you look at the ghost story that the BBC chose this year, which was an Arthur Conan Doyle story, that was about death. That was about what happens after we die and the way that mummies are preserved and how we can use the dead to persecute and torment the living, which is what Dracula does.
Absolutely. And like I was going to say, whereas Lauren said a nice Dublin accent would be great for narration, I was thinking more of a nice Buffalo, New York accent. you know, actually, all joking aside, I was so thrilled when I got your email, because you know how much we love you, Dacre. You're one of our favorite guests. Plus, on a personal level, I like you so much. And I always knew we had a lot in common. And then I found out the filmmaker you're working with is someone I'm working with on a project.
Really?
Yes. Yeah. Jason Figgis, now that I wrote a script for, and he's a great guy. So I was happy to hear when you were working with him that, ooh, he's working with a good guy. That makes me happy.
Well, that's ironic. I met Jason probably 10, 12 years ago at a film festival just outside of Dublin. Dunlary, and we started talking way back then about, you know, Nobody has done it the way it really should be done. You know, let's do it someday. And I said, you know, I'm just getting really into this whole business. I want to learn a lot more about Bram. Let's stay in touch. And we did. I would, every time I'd go to Dublin, we'd arrange to get together and have lunch or coffee or a pint of Guinness somewhere and just sort of stay on top of things. And we almost had a chance just before the pandemic to do documentary. We had, you know, sort of I'd say an overture of a lot of money from Saudi Arabia, which a lot of people get these possibilities, a lot of money from there. Everybody jumps to go, oh, they're gonna spend, they got all this money to spend. And we busted our butt to come up with a really good outline. And it was not only going to be Bram Stoker's life, but all the different locations around the world that were involved in the research and writing of Dracula. And then the, you know, the offer just ended for whatever reason. It just, the mirage evaporated. But we had some good research done. So we just kind of put it in the can, as they said, and waited. And then Jason came back to me and said, Dacre, this story needs telling. And we don't need a lot of money. We don't need Saudi Arabian money. And but what we need is some money for editing, which is an expensive thing when you've got to go to a studio and spend money on a studio to do all this editing. But in the meantime, what we did was I gave Jason names of people who were coming to Dublin for different events. And I set up interviews that Jason could go and do with them. So there's the usual talking heads that are, you know, really well-respected people in their field to talk about Bram and the movement, the spiritualist movement that was going on and things that would sort of, you know, caused Dracula to become something of interest at that time. And then I would go off on my tours that I was leading to Transylvania, to Whitby, England, to Cruden Bay, Scotland. And I'd usually have my friend Colin Hamilton come along purely on speculation. That was usually funded by myself or by him or a little bit of both to say, come along, we're going to do this tour. Let's get some footage of some of these really cool places that were involved in, you know, for instance, Bram's holiday in Whitby when I knew he was there in the summer of 1890 and I needed to get good imagery of Whitby Abbey, the graveyard. And Colin is incredible. He used to be a videographer for Sky TV and was embedded in wars around the world. And he got pretty tired of that hectic life and dangerous life. So now it's with Dacre traipsing around graveyards early in the morning or late at night. Or he learned how to sort of sneak out before anyone was around and fly his drone. And, you know, people get pretty upset of drones flying over historic places without licenses. But he would go up there at sort of 6 a.m. and no one would know. And we've actually put together some incredible footage in these places. He even came with me to the mountain in Transylvania, the volcano, where Bram left us the coordinates that give us confidence to say this is where he left. He planned his fictional castle Dracula. So we have imagery of that, good drone footage of that sort of thing. So we're going to have some very a lot of images still and moving and drone for Jason to use to edit this whole thing together. John West has written the narration with all of my input and my research. I've done some of the narration already. So, yeah, it's moving along. And I just got to ask if you're allowed to tell, Brian, can you give us a little hint about what your project with Jason Figgis is all about? Because I've certainly just told you all of mine.
Yeah, I don't know if I can. I can off the air.
Okay. Don't tell us anything that's going to get you in trouble. But are there any ghosts involved?
Maybe not really. No, okay. No. It's a historical biography, but it's not a documentary. It's a film.
Okay, because I know he's done. He's worked with some really interesting people.
Absolutely. And the great thing about Jason is he's not just a documentary filmmaker. I mean, he's also a really good horror filmmaker.
Oh, yeah.
Fantastic horror filmmaker. And his documentaries that he's branched out into are fantastic. I mean, he's a very, very good filmmaker.
Help me with this, because I'm having a mental block, but this will be fun. One of the gentlemen that he recently worked with played Dracula. And he's Irish, and his first name is Patrick.
Ooh.
Bergen. There we go. I answered my own question.
Yes, you did.
Patrick Bergen was a fellow that Jason said, Dake, I can't go to editing right now. I'm feeling it finished up Patrick Bergen. And I've got an interesting Patrick Bergen story. You know, he played with Julia Roberts in Sleeping with the Enemy. He also played in one of those, the films with Patriot Games.
Okay.
And I thought he was great, and I was coming to Dublin to do work at one of the Dublin Film Festival, and one of these other festivals that was also, you know, sort of highlighting Bram Stoker said, Dacre, we'd love to have you, and we're going to have Patrick Bergen interview you on stage and come to this theater. Well, it turned out to be a library, but nonetheless, I was all set for this interview that I was going to give to Patrick Bergen on stage in front of, you know, a couple hundred people. And it turned out, like, the day before, I got an email from the lady saying, well, I've kind of got it a little bit backwards. We want you to interview Patrick Bergen on stage with, like, now a day and a half to go. And I'm traveling and doing other events, and I've got to figure out, you know, exactly who Patrick Bergen is. I knew he played at Dracula once and other things. So I had to put this together. And I got back to her. I said, you know, this is kind of tough on short notice. Well, no problem. We'll just have the two of you interview each other. It will just be in conversation with Dacre and Patrick.
Oh, yeah, that's totally fine.
Yeah, totally fine with no notice. Because, you know, as you know, Brian and Lauren, you like to get prepared for, you know, having guests on and what are the talking points. So I went into that with very little prep, but I was just like, okay, Dacre, just pretend you're like, you know, school teacher, and you're in a classroom, and you just got to keep it going for a while with no lesson plan. It all didn't work, and you're just going to go with it. And it turned out to be wonderful. He was charming and interested in what I was doing, and I was interested in learning what he was doing. So I just, you know, asked questions, and it turned out to be an hour that went by very quickly. And certainly then the audience had lots of questions to both of us, and, you know, it turned out okay, but, you know, you always think of the worst, don't you? But that was one of the guys that Jason has recently filmed with. And the last thing I'll say before it's back to you guys is, have either of you seen his work with Sir Simon Marsden?
The
famous British photographer. Then tell your listeners about it, because that's the first thing I saw that got my attention, that Jason Figgis would be a great guy to work with. Because the way he produced and directed this story, it's a documentary, but it's a story about Marsden, the photographer, who was able to capture this great ghostly feel in the sort of Victorian era. So what are your impressions of Marsden's work by Figgis?
I loved it. I was lucky enough, he was working on that when him and I started the project we were collaborating on. So I was getting to hear about it as it was being done too, which was just unbelievable. Fantastic. I don't know, Lauren, have you ever seen it?
No, I haven't. No.
Oh, you'd love it.
Is it called the Twilight Hour?
The Twilight Hour. Yes.
Yeah. And so maybe people can see it on YouTube. I'm not sure how you'd see it nowadays, but it just gave the impression through kind of, you know, interesting photographic effects of sort of ghostly spirits that were present in really interesting places. And I've never seen things done like that before. And that really gave me the feeling that, you know, he would have the right sensitivity to work with. And I'm so glad that this is, you know, coming to fruition. And I keep saying, you know, we need to raise, I think, about $25,000 on Indiegogo so Jason can take all the stuff we've got and go and sit in for about a week, you know, a studio to do all of his editing and so on. But it's you know, most of the, everything else is done. It's just up to Jason now. I can sit back, as can John West, who did the writing of the script with my info. We can sit back and enjoy it. But, you know, it's going to tell everybody kind of things that I've already told you guys in some of our previous podcasts. Bram's life, how things in his own life were woven into the fabric of Dracula, some of them consciously, some of them unconsciously, how not just Dracula, but different, some of his different stories that he wrote also included things from his life, meeting Buffalo Bill Cody, and how he sort of got to become Quincy Morris and Elias Hutcheson and other characters. So it's sort of interesting to, you know, that I was charged with, it's Bram Stoker, the father of Dracula, but there's more to Dracula than just being the father of Dracula. It's the father of Dracula and other horror related kind of stories in his real life, that some of them would curdle your blood, but how those kind of came out in his writing.
He's also a key figure in the acceptance of performers. You'd mentioned earlier how theater people and performers were considered almost second-class citizens, and proper people wouldn't want to be associated with that type. You know, it really was Henry Irving and Sandra Bernhard and the Barrymores in America to some extent that legitimized theater. And Stoker had a great deal to do with that.
Yes. You know, he went to the theater as a child with his dad, and they loved to sort of do their own type of critiquing. You know, that was a bonding between a father and the son. And when Bram grew up, he missed that as a busy student and as a clerk. And then, as I said earlier in the show, he went back to actually the Dublin Evening Post and said, you guys need to do a better job with reviewing the theater, because people don't know what's going on. And how do readers know if the play is any good? But he also said, how do the producers and directors and the actors know how well they're acting in their script and their set designs are being accepted? So you've got it. And they said, we have no money for that. And Bram said, don't worry, I'll do it pro bono. So he loved the theater so much, but he also had that eye that you're talking about, Brian. He had the eye to make a difference and make things a little bit better. And he did it from a distance, really, as a theatrical critic. But when he got into the theater as the theater manager, one of the things he and Irving agreed upon were things like, if there are dialects to be used in the plays, they will be correct and they will be studied and they'll be done right. If there are historical images to represent in the sets, by God, they will be right. So these guys spent a lot of money, and this was something that drove Bram crazy, but he had to balance the books. But this was where his masters in mathematics came. They would head off to Scotland as a group, set designers and Stoker and Irving, to look at the different castles when they were going to cast and do Macbeth. They would go off to Nuremberg, Germany, when they were going to have Mephistopheles, Faust. So they would go and look and do these research trips, which cost a lot of money. But it mattered to them to get it right and to represent it properly. And the other thing is the sort of the decorum of the actors was to make sure they weren't drunk on stage, you know, and they didn't go out afterwards and make fools of themselves out in the pubs and so on. They wanted respectability. And that did come about. And as a result of that coming about over about a 5-10 year period, that the actors were making more money. They were being thought of much better. They had more patrons paying money. And Henry Irving became the first actor ever knighted. And that really sort of made a statement that an actor in that profession, the profession that Bram Stoker's father said not to be associated with, could actually be knighted by the Queen. And that opened the doors for obviously more actors, actresses, and the theaters to become profitable, and more effects, you know, moving from gas lighting to electric lighting to fancier costumes to really making these theaters something special. And those two were responsible for that from the beginning.
Yeah, in a huge way. Now, I do have to call you out a little bit on Irving insisting that they don't go out afterwards and make a fool of themselves. Not that it would make a fool of himself, but Henry Irving is the guy who kept the Beefsteak Club going. So,
well, yeah, but that was behind closed doors. That was in the Lyceum Theater, and he would party up hard. But he knew, very hard. Yeah, absolutely. But he also, I believe, I don't know what he knew, but I have a good feeling that with Bram in charge, he made sure that the public appearance of Henry Irving was quite different than that private. The guy that liked to party hard and that liked to womanize. he probably had a lot of work to do to keep that sort of under wraps, or at least as much as possible.
You know, I've been meaning to ask, I've been meaning to ask on several times you've been on, was Bram welcome or an official member of the Beefsteak Club?
Yes. He was a member, and he was also in charge of all the table seating arrangements when Irving had a dinner engagement there. And I can say that because Lauren may have heard of this place, but in the Shakespeare Center in England, I've seen my cousin went there, one of Bram's great grandsons, and took photographs. And one of them greatly helped me in my research. A dinner seating arrangement card that shows where Irving was seated next to a lady from Philadelphia, Mrs. McMichael, and her son and her husband were visiting. There was Bram Stoker, Mrs. Stoker, and then a guy called Grusha, who was the secretary of the prime minister of Hungary. And Grusha was traveling with Arminius Vanbury, who was also seated at the table next to Ellen Terry and Bram's other brother, Tom, and Mr. Loveday, the set designer. So this was one of the functions of the Beefsteak Club, besides, you know, partying hard after the play or entertaining potential patrons and so on. This was an interesting gathering because it happened in April of 1890. Just 4 months before Bram Stoker went off to Whitby. And does Arminius Vanbury ring a bell to either of you two or any of your listeners?
Oh, it does to me.
Well, then do tell. Come on. Who is it?
Take it, Lauren.
Oh, no, I let you have this one, Brian.
You were the one chuckling.
Oh, no. I think you should do the honors as the American.
Well, that's not nice.
So he was Hungarian.
Now, I was going to say he wasn't American to begin with.
No, he was Hungarian, but his name was mentioned twice in Dracula, which then gave J.D. Barker and myself great confidence to have him as a main character in Dracul.
And oh, my God, that's right. You did have him as a main character.
And he was a main character, and what we decided is, and we don't have any hard facts on this one, but when Arminius Vanbry is mentioned by Van Helsing, he says, "My friend Arminius of Budapest University tells me of who he must have been." And he goes into exact detail about what Bram Stoker found in two books about Vlad the Impaler. So he's a source of information about Vlad. And he was a professor at Budapest University, and he was sort of a traveling spy that later came out when Freedom Information Act in England was showed this. He was a very interesting character, and I found a couple of his books on Abe Books that I purchased. He had a very colorful past. But he was somebody that I believe at that dinner party told Bram Stoker about, you know, some of the goings on in Austrian Hungarian Empire, potentially Transylvania, Wallachia, and might have tweaked Bram's interest to go and look for a guy called Vlad Dracula when he got to a library that he could read a book by William Wilkinson and open the door on this interesting character, Vlad the Impaler, because that's what the book says. This is what my friend Arminius told me.
Yeah, here's the question, and I don't know if you can answer this. I don't know if we know for sure. Was Arminius actually close with them? Or do you think it was just your luminary who's in town come to the party?
That's a really good question. First of all, from what I understand, you didn't get an invite to the Beefsteak Room unless you were a really special person or you were fairly close to Bram and Bram wanted Irving to meet him for whatever, you know, political reason or patronage or something like that. You had to be pretty special to be invited to sit at that table. Now, I did see one other dinner where Vanbry was at the table, and it was a couple of years later than 1890. So it makes me believe these two guys maybe weren't fast friends, but were at least knew each other well enough and were familiar with each other. And Bram, you know, wanted him around. It's a good question. I have not found any letters between them, and that doesn't mean they weren't written. A lot of these things were destroyed, but that would be one of the really pieces of pure gold that I would love to find. And boy, oh boy, my wife and I have Google alerts on every sort of antiquarian auction site. Whenever anything comes up with any of the names associated with, you know, Stoker, Irving, Terry, Vanbury, Dracula, any of these names. And occasionally we get some very cool sort of insight because a letter comes up. And unfortunately, it says starting bid like $1,000. And it's like, whoa, I have actually taken the bait and purchased two of them over the years that I just could not let get away. There's one right now out there, if anyone's listening, that I think closes in about 30 days, which is interesting. I won't go too far off topic with it because it is a chapter from one of the last books Bram wrote. It's actually the second to last. His last book he wrote was Lair of the White Worm, but the one before that was Famous Impostors. And Famous Impostors was nonfiction. And it was all about, obviously, people who were imposters and sort of pulled the wool over the eyes of the public. And Bram Stoker was sort of exposing them. And the manuscript for this book has been sitting in Trinity College archives.
Wow.
With the exception of one chapter. Nobody knew where it was. And very recently, this chapter on, you'll love this one, you guys, mesmerism. Turned up.
Perfect.
Yep. And it is Bram's investigation into people who claimed to have contact with the undead or any of these things. Talked about Joseph Mesmer, who was pioneer in this area, but other people as well. And I'm really excited to be able to say this. The Rosenbach Museum has asked my help to help them raise funds to purchase this manuscript. They have first right of refusal on it for 3 weeks. And it's all been agreed that three famous scholars, Dracula scholars, that most of your listeners will recognize, I helped the Rosenbach get contact with their estates because they were all friends of mine who have passed away in the last 2.5 years. People who have done research on the Dracula notes or on Bram Dracula in general, Elizabeth Miller, Robert 18 Bassang, and David Skoll.
Who all just passed away.
Yeah, and so there's a fund being raised in their name, and the funds are going towards the purchase of this manuscript that, if they're successful, will be available to scholars at the Rosenbach, and it'll be that the fund will be perpetually named the Miller, 18 Bassang, and Skoll Fund that made this, the purchase of this manuscript possible. I think it's so appropriate, but also very, very interesting that, this thing has been floating around sort of in the ether for a while, and now it's sort of become recognized as something to get our hands on. In this day and age, you guys, where paranormal research, is huge and it's so, everybody's at it. It's like, let's go back to the guy that brought us Dracula, who's also very interested in mesmerism.
Of course he was. Look at the years. This was the height of the craze of spiritualism and stuff. I mean, I'm surprised we don't find more coming out that we do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Did I say, it remind me if this sounds familiar or not, that I found an article about 2 or 3 years ago from the Dundee newspaper about Bram Stoker being interviewed by a guy who went to a cocktail party for Henry Irving in Dundee, Scotland, and found Bram Stoker much more interesting because he was actually talking about around the fireplace to some very interested guests, and they were exchanging stories about sort of the paranormal, and Bram regaled them in two specific incidents where he believed the people that Bram was interacting with experienced spirits of the dead, or they had the ability to see. They were called seers, or possessed second sight. And this guy was writing about it, like Bram Stoker, the famous theater manager and author, has actually explaining in detail what he heard that night. And in one case, it was a mother who had two children, an infant in arms and about a five-year-old. And the five-year-old came into the room when the mother was feeding the little child and saying, "She won't play anymore with me. She's dead." Mother said, "What are you talking about? She's right here. She's fine." "No, soon to be dead," something like that. And then came back a little bit later and crying. "Oh, she's gone. And it's like, "No, she's right here. She's in the cradle. See, she's right here. She's fine." The next day, the baby died. Not ill, nothing. And so it's like, just up and died, as they say. And so it's like Bram is saying this 5-year-old had some kind of premonition or second sight. And a very similar situation with a shooting guide, a ghillie, they call them, in Cruden Bay, Scotland, where Bram wrote Dracula. He was out at a shooting party, shooting pheasant and by the Earl of Errol. And Bram was...
Say that 5 times quick.
I won't try that, Brian. Bram was out there, and the ghillie, they were chatting, you know, and they would load the gun and hand it to you. And Bram said, well, how is the Earl? The ghillie said, the sheet is getting high. And Bram sort of looked at me. He knew what that meant. And for your listeners, do you guys know what it means when they say the sheet is getting high?
I do not.
It means the sheet that they pull up over the body when you die is getting high.
Oh, not an American term we use.
No, definitely Scottish. And Highlands Scottish, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, it's like it's getting pulled up higher. So Bram's go, oh, that's too bad. Has he shown any signs of sickness? And he just nodded his head. And then next year, Bram was invited back. We know Bram went back to Cruden Bay, Scotland, at least 12 summers, and that's where he did all his writing. He was invited out, and he actually requested the same ghillie, the loader, because he wanted us to sort of chastise him, because the Earl of Errol looked totally healthy. He'd invited him out for another shoot. So he had this guy, and he goes, well, I guess you were wrong. The sheet was not getting high on the Errol. He goes, oh, yes, it's very close now. He goes, but he looks totally fine. You know, he's not coughing. His color is good and so on. And he just nodded his head. And while Bram was in Cruden Bay for that holiday, the Earl of Errol died unexpectedly of a brain aneurysm.
Okay. As long as you said brain aneurysm and you're not blaming Bram, okay?
Not a Bram aneurysm. So... This, I mean, it's long-winded, folks, but Bram definitely had an interest in this, and this manuscript is out there, and, you know, hopefully Roosevelt will raise the money, and hopefully we'll raise the money for our Indiegogo campaign, and all of this type of stuff that I'm telling you, all of these ideas, this background into Bram's life, it's not just, yep, here's the books he looked at, here's the same old vampire crap that everybody tells you comes from Transylvania. Yes, some of that will be explained and the books he used and the writers that he read. But we've got some other stories to sort of, you know, make Bram's life look much more interesting, which it was, and find some interesting insight beyond the normal stuff.
Exactly. And folks, think about this. This is a documentary about the man who created the most iconic figure in modern history, and it could be near you. Give us some deets on where they can access the GoFundMe, how to do it, all that stuff before we go on to our next little bit.
Yeah, because
I've done that a couple times.
Yeah, I mean, it's Indiegogo is one of the more popular crowdfunding sources for film. Because the one thing that I've learned about Kickstarter and GoFundMe is that those, and Zoop, by the way, that I've used for comic books, those are all or nothing type things. So if you give funds to Indiegogo and we don't hit our mark, the funds still end up going to the production and the editing, even though if we don't hit the 20 grand. And we're gonna do it regardless, even if we have to go into debt ourselves. But it's still helpful. So it starts April 1st, Indiegogo, and look for Father of Dracula by Figgis and West and Stoker. And any contributions would be, you know, most appreciated. And you know, I think what would be cool now of you guys is, why don't you hit me with, you know, other ideas or thoughts or questions about, will this thing be included in the documentary? I mean, you guys have gotten very knowledgeable over the years. You've always asked me great questions about, you know, different parts of Bram's life, where he may have been inspired, or different research they did or different things that we've talked about over the years or other people. So
I've got a couple of mine. Yeah. So Lauren, you can go first because I've got a couple of mine, but I know you do too, because Lauren is such a stoker nut that, well, you know that. So.
First thing I'd like to say is thinking about, again, having a bit of think about the narration, I think it would be quite a novel thing if you had it, if one of the characters from Dracula was narrating it, as if they were telling the story of their creator.
Which one in particular would you like to hear?
I don't think Dracula would do it because I think he would get bored.
Branfield wouldn't be allowed to.
No, because either Dracula would stop him or he'd have to be sedated. I was thinking maybe Jonathan Harker because of the letter writing. And yeah. That would be a good thing. I always feel sorry for him after the last big adaptation, the BBC adaptation of Dracula, where he didn't really get to finish his story because he was killed. So I think he needs a bit of love and to be given something important to do.
And I always feel bad for him after the Keanu Reeves fiasco.
But that's fine.
Look, no offense to Keanu. I like Keanu. He was almost my next door neighbor for a week. That's a true story I could tell you later. But he just did not play the character right in that movie. I'm sorry.
I agree. It's too bad because he's a good actor.
Yes.
In other areas, but he shouldn't. It wasn't fair that he was miscast.
He was very miscast. Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah.
For me, I think it would have to be Van Helsing, because I think that in some ways that he felt that he was the Van Helsing to his friends and family, where he would be the problem solver. And I think another thing I would be interested in is how are you going to interpret the relationship with Hawkeye?
We are definitely a good thing, you know, for your listeners. Hawkeye was the person that Bram dedicated Dracula to. So if you open up, most worthwhile copies of Dracula will have "to Hommy Beg." It doesn't sound too much like Hawkeye, but Hawkeye came from this funny little place called the Isle of Man, and they have some different vernaculars, a different language. And in Manx, that was his nickname. Hawkeye was a much more famous writer than Bram Stoker was in his time. Hawkeye was a very interesting character and got involved in mentoring Bram in many ways, sometimes formally and informally. They both were involved in stopping plagiarism. They both testified against plagiarism and what laws need to be in place.
They were also both critics.
They were both critics, and Hawkeye, very successful, loaned Bram money when he was had difficult times when he did a stupid investment, but his good friend Mark Twain not tricked him, because I've seen the letters back and forth, got him to invest in a page compositor, which is a big sort of printing thing. Bigger than a typewriter, but smaller than a printing press, but a way to print papers and print things on papers. It didn't work. It was too complicated. The Italian fellow that was doing it was far too complicated, and they lost their money. But I do know this for a fact, and I've seen the letters, that Mark Twain did his best, and he found an American who had a lot of money in the oil business and was working and did actually pay back the people that lost the money, but not for a long time. So their relationship is almost like a father son, but a little bit more like equals. But definitely Bram looked up to Hawkeye as somebody that knew an awful lot more about writing than he did. And also, Paul Kane was more sort of worldly. He had already had books published in Scandinavia, in Iceland, and I think paved the way for Bram to have books there. So Bram sort of owes a lot to Hall Caine. But nowadays, nobody knows who Hall Caine is. So we are definitely going to be touching on that. Rather symbiotic relationship.
I did know about the investor being able to pay them back, because one of the things is I know that some Stoker historians criticize Hall Caine for making Bram come over to see him, or not, he didn't make him, when Bram wasn't very well himself, because Hall Caine took to his bed and Bram came over. But then I always thought it was something to do with the fact that maybe Bram knew that this could have been a final illness and was trying to settle some affairs with him, because I know that when Hall Caine lent him money, that the only way Bram could pay him back was to hand over his life insurance policy. So on Bram's death, that's when he could pay back Hall. So that's what I always thought, is that he went over there to, you know, to sort that out and to make sure that was all, you know, dealt with. And that's probably why Hall Caine took to his bed, because I think if I was in a position like Hall Caine to help out a friend, and I knew that the only way that they could pay me back was their life insurance, and that possibility was getting near, I think I'd take to my bed as well.
I can't verify that. I do know that the money Bram lost on the Mark Twain investment was paid back to Bram and Irving. But I don't know. I don't have the same facts that you're referring to. But I do know that Bram was the type of person that would have made sure he would have paid back and got everything sort of straight in the end. Now, some biographers say, oh, Bram was you know, left his wife with nothing. That is not true. Bram actually had a decent sized estate when he died, and also his brother Thornley left her money. See, Bram died before Thornley did, but Thornley died just a few months later, and Thornley didn't have any heirs. He was very rich. He was a successful doctor, had lots of fine furnishings, so he made sure that Florence and the young son Noel had plenty of money, and then Noel became very successful as a chartered accountant. So she did okay, and then she did actually quite well, even though the Nosferatu debacle, she didn't end up with any money from the court settlement. She did quite well when the theatrical rights, the stage rights, were sold. She did quite well, very well, in fact, there. So at the end of the day, whatever sort of happened to Bram and those who had loaned him money and mistakes he'd made, things turned out okay in the end.
Yeah. I always remember, and I don't know if this is true, but it was a story that I was told, is that when the rights to Dracula were sold and Bela Lugosi got the part, that he went and spoke to Florence as well. And I just think that's so lovely that he would do that.
And, you know, I've heard that. And I've heard it from more than one source, but I've never seen any of that in writing, or never heard that, you know, never seen it in a Bram's journal. It could be absolutely true, or it could be not true. I've also heard that he tried to get a hold of her and wanted the rights really badly, wanted Universal to buy this thing. But what we do know is that when Hamilton Dean and Florence collaborated on the first stage play, which, funnily enough, the 100th anniversary in Derby is happening this May, and I'm going to be over there helping them celebrate the 100th anniversary of Dracula, first time on stage in Derby. When that happened, and then later there was other actors prior to Bela Lugosi, Raymond Huntley being one of them. But when it then was picked up in the U.S. and Lugosi, you know, really got very famous for it, and John Balderston helped that whole play become very popular. When Universal, so this goes way back to 27. In 31, when Universal bought the rights, they bought the rights from Dean Balderston and Mrs. Stoker for the stage rights, from the stage play, not the book rights. So they actually realized that, well, we've already got a play. It's already been, the book is so complicated, and it's already been boiled down to scenes and acts and so on. We're just going to buy those rights as opposed to the book rights, and then we could do whatever we want with it. And I find that very interesting, and I also find it telling. And Laura, you mentioned earlier on, you know, oh, the BBC Netflix co-production of Gaddis and Moffat. It nobody has done it as Bram Stoker wrote it. It has been done many different ways, sometimes adapted from different stage versions, sometimes totally reimagined like Moffat and Gaddis did. So I'm still waiting for someone to do it the way Bram wrote it. But that's okay. I got plenty of time to wait.
You know, it's funny. another friend of our show's and former guest is the granddaughter of Bela Lugosi. And I can reach out to her and see if she has anything confirming that Bela had reached out to or met with Florence.
That would be helpful.
I'll send her an email. I'd love to get the two of you on a show together. That would be so cool.
We've done a show together, not with you guys. We'd love to do it. She's great. Lynn Lugosi Spears is great. And that would be a very cool opening question. I can't believe why we haven't resolved that between us. But that would be great if you could find that out.
I do have one more question, and it's
please go ahead, Lauren.
With Hall Caine, there is the element, and I know that there are books out there saying that Bram knew Francis Tumblety, and I know that is a bit contested from all areas. And so has that been broached in the documentary?
No, because we have absolutely no proof. There's so many things, Lauren, just like that. And they say that Hall Caine knew Tumblety, therefore Bram must have known Tumblety, therefore, you know, he's a Jack the Ripper suspect, therefore Bram Stoker, who mentioned the words Jack the Ripper in the Icelandic preface, Bram must have known this. Bram Stoker and Henry Irving delayed certain plays during the Ripper reign. I mean, it's been so, to me, amusing that people have been kind of throwing these theories up against the wall and seeing what lands and what falls. Because it's such an interesting time, the Victorian era, with all of this weird stuff going on, and you throw in all these different potential Jack the Rippers floating around, that Tumblety seemed to be a pretty good version of one of them, or a pretty good suspect. But I haven't seen anything in either Bram's notes, his journal, his typescript, any letters, anything from the family. And believe me, folks, I have dug through all the stuff that exists at Trinity, all the things that John Moore had before it was sold to Emery, letters, and the things that are still within the family on the Isle of Wight. I have not seen anything. Right now it's great urban legend, but until I actually see something, I'm not going to put that into a documentary unless there's sort of a kernel of enough circumstantial evidence, you know?
Yeah, no, because there were certain plays that they were hesitant to put on during that period, and that was them trying to anticipate what the Lord Chamberlain would say, because the Lord Chamberlain still had control over, you know, it wasn't as much as it was, but it was still something that he was still the theatre censor. And I think they were trying to avoid getting the Lord Chamberlain involved, and him, you know, you going that through that Shakespearean thing of where he was closing down theatres to stop mass hysteria.
Yeah.
I think it's important to say that it is possible that Bram had an interest in Jack the Ripper. I mean, Arthur Conan Doyle was another first people that went on a Ripper tour. I mean, this, but just because they did that, just because it was part of their lives and they were reading it in newspapers, doesn't make them, you know, in the know of who committed the murder as it does us when we read a newspaper article on a murder or a crime that takes place today. And I think, you know, as years have gone by, the link between Bram and Tumblety has certainly become very thin. I know there is a good link between him and Hawkeye. That cannot be disputed. There is documented evidence. But whether that then became something that Bram got involved in, I don't think. I think he would have been wise enough to have avoided that completely and just let Hall get on with that and just carry on with his own life. Because I don't think he would have allowed somebody like that into his life because of Ellen Terry, his own wife, the actresses around him. He just wouldn't have even bothered, I don't think.
I think you're right. Again, it's hard to say. I think the way you have just stated it is probably true. Bram was very busy, had a lot of people wanting a FaceTime with Irving or Ellen Terry, and Bram was sort of the guy that was the one holding these people off. He was the filter, as well as very, you know, reputable people in the news media that wanted to have interviews and so on. So but there is a close connection. I mean, Irving and Hall Caine were very close, and it wouldn't be strange that if Hall Caine said, "Hey, Bram, I got this guy. He wants to come see a play. Can we have dinner at the afterwards at the Beefsteak Club? And let's do that." He might have. We don't know.
Yeah, I spent many years doing Tumblety research, and one thing that I cannot stand is people who just want to jump to conclusions and state things as fact when they're not. And that's way too common, especially with anything having to do with the Ripper. Look, if Bram Stoker knew Tumblety, he would have known.
Lauren, are you still there?
I am still here, yeah.
Somehow we just lost Brian talking about if he had known Tumblety, he probably would have given him a wide berth.
I think so. He may have known the story. He may have known the story of Hall Caine's meeting and dealing with him. But yeah. I think to Bram, it would have just been a story and he'd have just avoided it because it would have just made his life difficult. It would have brought scandal on to the Lyceum, yeah. Especially because, you know, Tumblety.
Yeah, Bram was against, I mean, he was against scandal. He didn't need any more scandal. I would agree with what you're saying. I'm just going to send a message to Brian to see if we still have him, because he's recording this.
I've started recording it until he comes back.
Oh, you are? Oh, good. Okay. What else have you, any other question you have, because those are excellent questions about things that might be included, things you think are important in Bram's life, about his research, his writing, that, you know, should be in a documentary about him.
Yeah. I was just curious to know, is his visit to Swansea ever documented? Because I just think that's so amazing because it is written about, and the way that the audience reacted to Henry Irving, because it was part of his final tour.
Yeah. And
that's such a gorgeous story that they all sang my Him, Love and Hard Eye. And no other audience reacted like that, not even in Cardiff. And I'm so proud that it was a Swansea audience that gave him a rousing chorus of that.
Yeah, that was huge, and I know lots of those important little events. We've got a bullet points of highlights. So I'll tell you what you could do to politic, and here's the way to do it: is since Brian knows Figgis so well, why don't you shoot an email to Brian and copy me and say, "I sure hope you guys include something about on Henry Irving's farewell tour, the sort of the rousing, you know, response he got in Swansea, something like that, and say, I'd love to see that in the documentary. So here we are, sort of, you know, I mean, that's the one wonderful thing about, you know, not doing this with some huge established studio in Hollywood or something is, you know, we can, you know, listen to what the people want. So I would, Lauren, shoot an email to that extent to Brian and me and say, let's pass this on to Jason Figgis and see what he thinks.
Because it was, I think it was so spontaneous, and it was such a way to honor him as well, you know. And it was the one song that the audience could do spontaneously because it was the national anthem.
Right. You know, yeah.
And I do remember in the archive in Swansea, you can find oral stories. And I think I've said this before, but there was a group of young boys and they met him. And I think they tried to outdrink him and they didn't.
Oh, wow.
But from that meeting, they describe a very generous man with his time, and he answered their questions, and they knew that, you know, they were young. They knew that they were probably bothering him. But a few of them, when they wrote poetry, and I have to go back and check this if I can, but a few of them took their bardic name from that meeting, from, you know, from Bram's name. So that was interesting to know that he did inspire a generation of yeah. young men to write just from meeting him in a pub after a show.
Sure. No, that is cool. It's heartwarming, really, to think that, you know, the big stars of the day will still hang around with some young lads and, you know, enjoy themselves, but also impart their wisdom. You know, that's a nice thing.
It is. And there's so many stories where Bram is doing that. And it's just so lovely to see that, because with some of the Victorian writers, you know, that they're a great wit or anything, but none of them are really people that seem to have that human touch to be able to interact with everybody.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. That's it. Well, let me ask you this. I can't remember in our chats. Have you ever been to Cruden Bay, Scotland, or up near Aberdeen, any of that area?
No, I haven't. No, I used to go to Sheffield Hallam University. So when I was in university, I did go and visit Whitby.
Yeah. Okay. So what were your impressions of Whitby then? As a, you know, we all know it played a major role on Bram changing the count from landing in Dover to now he lands in Whitby. And you know, what was your feeling about the way that little town looks?
I think he was right, because, you know, Dracula, as well as being a Gothic novel, it's also an example of invasionist literature, where you're talking about a foreign invader coming in and becoming quite sinister. And I think it was clever, because Dover is a main port, and, you know, you couldn't exactly have Dracula coming into a main port and causing chaos. That would just be too obvious. He'd be thwarted straight away. But if he came a bit like a Viking up in the north, yeah, and started working his way down, there's something a bit more sinister. You know, it's almost like somebody getting in through the back door. And I think it's such a normal fishing village. It would have been very typical. Nothing bad would have happened. Ships would have gone in and out. Small ships like the Demeter would have gone in and out. No problem. And but what I really do think people will miss is that the bullhorn that used to sound when it was foggy. And I've you can listen to it on YouTube, the bull of Whitby. But hearing that, you'd really get the shivers, especially on a foggy night, thinking, oh, gosh, what's out there? What's coming in?
Well, I'm glad you said that, because I'm going to tell you triggered a memory. I'm going to tell the first time I went to Whitby. It was to do filming with a Canadian documentary group, and I'd heard so much about it, and it was, did all my research, and I knew where we wanted to do our interviews and so on. And we'd contacted a guy by the name of John Stokoe, who was the head of the Whitby Gazette, and he was set to meet us at the Duke of York pub at the bottom of the 109 steps when we arrived. So we drove, we met in London, left early in the morning and drove all the way, which is a long drive with the whole film crew. Got in at evening, checked into our hotel. And then I said, okay, guys, you know, this, you know, cell phones had been invented. So we had cell phones. So we arranged to meet John Stokoe. And it was February, cold, damp, dark. The sea mist was rolling in. And we make our way through this thick fog across the bridge and to the Duke of York pub to have a pint, meet with John. And we could see the steps, the 199 steps heading up the hill to Whitby Abbey and the St. Mary's Church. And they were marked off with that yellow police tape. And John, being a newspaper editor, had one of those scanner things. He said, oh, guys, I'm really sorry. Can't go up there tonight. We hadn't planned it anyway. It was late. He said, there's been a jumper. He said, what? He said, yeah, suicide. The, you know, when you get up on top, Lauren, as you will probably remember, there is a steep cliff down to the ocean. Somebody had jumped over and committed suicide. And apparently, you know, that happened from time to time. But also, as I had dug into it, there was also something strange about that graveyard that Bram capitalized in the novel that made it even spookier. That there are empty graves in the graveyard with headstones that will say the name and the date of birth and the date of death and a pretty good idea. They say the location, it might be Greenland or somewhere, because Whitby was a big sailing, fishing and whaling port. And imagine this, you know, the sons of Whitby would go off in the fishing industry and they may die far away in a horrifying accident or a drowning or something. And so their souls are in the bottom of the ocean somewhere. Their souls are not at rest after a service and resting in a consecrated graveyard. So there are superstitions that these fogs are simply the souls of the dead, this ghostly fog swirling about that comes in when the cool air and the warm water mix, or the warm air and the cool water mix, you have this ghostly kind of fog coming in. They're looking for their places to rest in peace. And we were talking about that with John and the other guys, the film crew, on our first night there. And it has stuck with me for the past 12 years. It's just that really cool feeling of the meeting of science, why this mist really happens, and superstition, how it's interpreted, and the history of Whitby with these strange graves with the bodies somewhere else, but trying to return to come the dead. And Brand touched on that in one of my favorite passages in the novel, when the Count is coming into Whitby in this supernatural type storm with the ship under full sail. Of course, no crewmen left. They've all died or jumped overboard. And it's being blanketed by fog, as it's, you know, sort of protected by this fog, the souls of the undead bring it into Whitby Harbor.
Oh, I know, it's such an evocative passage. It's amazing. And I think that now you say it, there is something spectral about fog that you could be, you know, because if you're walking with somebody, you can't quite see them, you know, are they still there? It is sort of like a veil drawing between this.
Yes, sure is.
And I think, you know, again, I think, you know, the reason that Bram could write so evocatively was, you know, he didn't have any television. He had to think about things and he had to, you know, ruminate over things and sort of, you know, there would be, he'd have more of a capacity to write it down and edit it. Whereas a society that wants everything now, whereas, you know, he could take time over it and enjoy it and immerse himself in that world just as much as a reader would.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, there was a lot of, you know, sort of visualization in his life because he was a theater guy. And he was a writer. And somebody once said, I think it was a review I read from the Detroit Free Press, Bram Stoker writes with the eye of a painter because he describes the scenery so vividly. Now, well, I haven't said this in this show. I've mentioned it before. Bram, while he was busy in Dublin as a university student, as a clerk at Petty Session doing theatrical reviews, he was also a founding member of the Dublin Painting and Sketching Club. So he was an amateur artist. And so when someone says he writes with the eye of the painter, by golly, he was right. Bram did have an artistic eye. I have seen some of his sketches. They weren't beautiful. They were mostly sketches so he could get Whitby right, so he could get the relationship between where the Whitby piers are, where the beach is, where the steps are, where the church is, where the abbey is, and so on and so forth. So he was doing, but I've seen other sketches attributed to Bram that are very interesting and, you know, not ghosts or vampires, but, you know, horses and women and children, that kind of stuff, practicing. I have been in contact with the members, the present day members of the Dublin Painting and Sketching Club, and they're very proud of their association with Bram. And they've got many other very famous artists from Dublin involved. So there we go. I'm trying to think to wind this down, Lauren, what other things we should talk about that people might be interested in that are going to be included in this documentary, or what some of their thoughts may be. Have you got any closing thoughts about what else you'd like to see in the documentary on Indiegogo that's going to start in April the 1st, Father of Dracula?
Well, I think the idea of him as an artist is very interesting, because that means that he spent time with, you know, not just writing these scenes, but drawing them as well. You know, because there's something very, you know, when you draw a scene, it's something very intimate because it's just you and the paper. And I think that would be, you know, an interesting documentary in itself, Bram as an artist. I mean, because he was around art all the time, not just acting, but the scenery. And, you know, and in London, you know, he'd have been able to have gone off to the, you know, the Royal College and seen all the artists. And I think that would open up a new dimension trying to explore Bram as an artist in his own right.
Yeah, I could almost see, almost like what you were saying earlier, where you've got narration from a character in Dracula, you know, a Mina or a Jonathan Harker. But you might have Bram, who you hear his words as he is describing. I mean, and he goes into great detail into the landscapes of Transylvania. And I have been there. I lead tours there. And I have these books with me. I have the words with me as we're going through what he calls the Mittelland and sees the Carpathian Mountains and so on. Just imagine if you could have those words being narrated while you have somebody who is depicting Bram drawing them on sort of a palette as it's being filmed. It sort of comes to life with his words. And then this, you've got somebody drawing it. I mean, we might have to get some sort of artificial intelligence to help us do that. But I think that idea would be very powerful. This sort of the imagery come to life through the words that he has already written. So we're almost doing it in reverse. Instead of seeing the imagery and then the writing come out of it, we have the description first and the pictures come out of that. That might be an interesting... I should talk to Jason about that. See if that's something that he could make happen during his editing phase.
I think that would be amazing. Just to have sort of, you don't even have to see Bram's face. So as long as you've got somebody tall enough, you could have them wearing a hat. Because I would imagine it would be sunny, and as a redhead, he would need to protect himself from the sun. And just his back and him drawing and him and these words just. As he's drawing, he's creating the wordscape along as the picturescape as well.
Guess who's back?
Hey,
there we go. We were just thinking of winding this down with one of my sort of closing thoughts. So, Brian, this is a great time to think about this.
Well, can I add one thing?
Please
do. What I was going to say, when I got cut off, we were talking about Tumble Tea. Sorry, everybody. My internet completely shit the bed. They've been doing work on the lines around my apartment, so it's been crazy all day. But I spent many years, I mean years, researching Tumble Tea. And one thing that I absolutely hate and despise is when people make assumptions and want to run with them like they're fact. Because they don't want to separate fact from fiction. They want the craziness to be true, so they promote it as though it's true with no evidence. The guy's life was crazy enough without having to embellish just to claim he was Jack the Ripper, case closed, which no one will ever be able to do. But that being said, if he were, or even a suspect, Stoker wouldn't have known that. Nobody would have known that at the time. It's not like people would be like, "Hey, this is my friend Frankie. He's a Jack the Ripper suspect." That wasn't happening.
Yeah.
Now, my personal opinion is they may have come across each other primarily for two reasons. One, Tumble Tea was a theater freak. He was obsessed with theater, whether he was in the U.S. or in the U.K. Tumble Tea was obsessed with theater, which is got good with John Wilkes Booth and people like that. Two, he had the connection with Hall Caine, which might have been a thing when he was in London for Hall Caine to take him to the Lyceum. At which point he probably would have met or at least been introduced to Stoker. But I think Stoker would have absolutely hated Tumble Tea. So I don't think any relationship would have formed. The kind of character Tumble Tea was definitely not the kind of character Bram Stoker liked or would have wanted to be around. And Henry Irving would have fucking run as fast as he could away from a Tumble Tea. So did they meet? Possibly to probably. Did they know each other? No, I don't think so.
And I share a lot of that sentiment, Brian, but you said it so well. But let me transition to this to sort of wind this down. And that's the ending. Let's talk a little bit about, you know, how you think. I mean, we, the three of us know Bram Stoker's life sort of ended sadly. You know, his health he had a stroke. There was Bright's disease in the family. There is speculation that he had syphilis. Who knows? There was never any record. I'm sorry?
I don't think that he did have syphilis because some of the symptoms match, but he doesn't really have the catastrophic mood swings or the violence or, you know, the general descent into chaos that a syphilitic mind has in the last stages of the disease. I think the way that it may have been written about is that the stroke may have done more damage than the Victorian doctors could have anticipated or known about. And sometimes, you know, stroke damage can cause mobility issues and may have excused the way that he walked, because I know one historian said the way that he walked indicates that he had syphilis, and that's not true. I just think the stroke did more damage than people thought it did, and it just took a while to but I don't think he had I don't think he had GPI. And I know lots of people say that exhaustion was the kind way that they put on death certificates. I just think it was a lot of what we now know about strokes wasn't known then. And the way that it was written about has been taken the wrong way. I just think it was the stroke.
I will add to that by saying that it's wonderful to speculate and to sensationalize things by saying, oh, there was syphilis. You know, oh, there's got to be this. But when you also think, one more thing to add to exactly the position you've taken, Lauren, is, how do you write books up until almost you die? Famous Impostors in 1911 and Lair the White Worm in 1912. How can you write those if you've got advanced syphilis? You know, the brain basically being chewed away. So somewhat unlikely, but let's go with this is what we're trying to imagine Jason, myself, and John West is how do you sort of wind this thing down so it's not a super sad and drab ending of a guy that created Dracula throughout a large portion of his life and had things in his life that were ever since, you know, starting as a kid, listening to the stories of his mother, Irish folklore and so on, and then experiencing things on the theater and then doing all this research. And then his life kind of winds down and he never gets a chance to see how immensely popular this book became.
I know exactly how to do it.
Tell me.
And I could tell you on the air if you want, but, you know, someone might steal your idea. But what you do at the end of the documentary is you go through the death and how, you know, tragic it was. But then you show how he changed the world. He changed the world of literature, which in turn changed the world of theater, which in turn changed the world of film. He has had such a cultural impact since his demise that the fucking Romanian tourist trade owes everything to him.
You're right. Yeah.
I mean, that's how big an impact he's had. And you show that it wasn't just a novel that scared people and sold a lot of copies. This guy literally changed the world that we live in with this book. That's how you end it.
Well, I got no argument with that. Lauren, do you agree?
I do, but if it was a docudrama, I'd probably just have him sort of going to sleep and then dreaming of being in one of his mother's stories and then it just ending. But that's me.
Yes, but as a documentary.
Yeah, exactly. Out. Yeah. Well, guys, it's been great. Sorry we lost you for a little bit, Brian, but Lauren has recorded everything.
I'm just hoping you guys made fun of me properly when I was gone.
Oh, you wait till you hear what we said about you.
Oh, I can't wait. I'll be doing the editing, don't forget.
Well, listen, best of luck with your project with Jason Figgis. We start ours one more time, The Father of Dracula on Indiegogo. If you want to see this thing made, please go and consider contributing to us starting April 1st. And in the meantime, you know, I'll take all these interesting ideas and run them by the boys. And, you know, we've got a pretty good idea of where we're going, but it's always nice to chat to folks like you who listen to the pulse of your listeners and have great insight, writers yourselves, filmmakers, all that good stuff. So thank you for having me on and appreciate the support you guys always give me.
You're welcome.
Thank you. And stick around when we finish recording for 1 minute, just so I can tell you about the thing I'm doing with Jason.
Yes, I will. Okay.
So from the great legendary great grandnephew of a legend, Dacre Stoker, this is Brian in Buffalo.
And Lauren from Swansea.
Saying good night.
Good night. Idiopathic intracranial hypertension, which it wasn't anywhere near my bum.